Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 124, Back Across the Delaware. So last week, as the Battle of Trenton came to an end by mid-morning on December 26, 1776, the Americans held the town and the few remaining enemy soldiers scattered. Amazingly, the Americans suffered no combat deaths and only 5 wounded. However, several men later died from the horrific march through the storm the night before. There are several accounts of deaths later that night and in the following days from exhaustion, exposure, and hypothermia. Despite the victory, Washington could not simply sit back and enjoy the moment. There were still thousands of Hessians under Colonel Carl von Donop to his south in Mount Holly, along with more Hessian and British regiments to his north in Princeton. Around 400 or 500 Hessians at Trenton had escaped, along with many Hessian women and children camp followers. Most of these endured a 10-mile forced march to Princeton. Of course, as word reached these other regiments, there was always a chance of a counterattack. Washington deployed some companies to march north or south looking for Hessians who had fled the field of battle. They also searched buildings in town looking for enemies still in hiding. General Washington, along with General Greene, visited the dying Hessian commander, Colonel Rawl, at the Methodist Church. After his death, Colonel Rawl would take the primary blame for the day's loss. British leaders noted his failure to build defensive entrenchments around town or to send out sufficient patrols to detect the enemy as they crossed the river. But, of course, hindsight is 20/20. Most of the other outpost commanders had behaved similarly to Rawl before the attack. As Colonel Rawl lay dying, the Continentals collected prisoners and secured the town. The dead were looted of anything of value. The capture of clothing, equipment, and cannons all added to the American victory. The Hessian prisoners had been told to expect to be killed if they were captured. The frightened prisoners were relieved to be treated reasonably well. Some had equipment taken from them, such as their knapsacks. The Hessian brass helmets were also highly prized by the victors. The Hessians would be marched back to the river and transported on the same boats used by the Continentals at McConkie's and Johnson's Ferry, where they were moved to Pennsylvania. Now, earlier in the day, a few of the Hessians and equipment were actually crossed at the closer Trenton Ferry. That's where General Ewing had been unable to cross the night before. But some of the same problems that prevented General Ewing from crossing continued into the next day, and as weather conditions worsened a little again, the Continentals marched most of the prisoners back to McConkie's and Johnson's Ferry, where they still had those larger Durham boats for transportation. Once in Pennsylvania, the prisoners spent a few days with the army. Washington then moved them to Philadelphia, where he ordered the officers separated from the men. Both were treated reasonably well, but he wanted the enlisted men to be taught about the ideals of liberty, so that if returned, these ideals might spread through the Hessian ranks. Eventually, the prisoners would be transported to the western parts of Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. There, many of them lived on parole among German-speaking colonists. Most of them were able to live and work in the communities with certain restrictions on how far they could travel and with nightly curfews. Many of the soldiers enjoyed their new conditions so much that they opted to stay in America after the war. There were 48 wounded Hessian officers and men, including the injured commander Colonel Rawl, who received parole. This meant that they were left in Trenton under the promise that they would not take up arms again unless exchanged for American prisoners. However, the reality was most of these wounded were so severely wounded that they would not survive. A trip back to Pennsylvania would almost certainly kill them. Colonel Rawl, as I said, died that evening. But one young lieutenant with a spinal injury remained in Trenton convalescing for several months. Washington conferred with his generals about whether they should continue their attack by taking the fight to Princeton or Mount Holly, or whether it would be better to take the win and simply retreat back to Pennsylvania before the enemy could counterattack. Washington's initial plan had been to meet up with the forces under Colonel John Cadwallader and General James Ewing, who, as I said, were supposed to have crossed further downriver the same night that Washington crossed, and that they were to attack the 3,000 British and Hessian soldiers at Mount Holly. But since neither of those crossings had been successful, Washington found himself on his own. The Americans, of course, were exhausted. Many were suffering from hypothermia and frostbite as well. The weather was also still a mix of snow and freezing rain that made any movement on the roads miserable and would likely increase the deaths related to hypothermia. It did not help that the soldiers had also discovered several barrels of rum in town, and many of them got roaring drunk before the officers discovered what they had done. The Americans still had the 900 Hessian prisoners to control as well. At least part of the army would have to remove the prisoners to Pennsylvania, even if the rest decided to engage the enemy at another location or stayed in Trenton to await a counterattack. If the Continentals moved against the enemy at Mount Holly, they would be attacking a force that was larger than they were. The force in Mount Holly was probably about twice as large as the Trenton garrison. And also, the attackers would no longer have the element of surprise. In the end, Washington decided to take their prisoners and captured booty and pull everyone back to Pennsylvania. The army spent the rest of the day and another sleepless night attempting to recross the Delaware River. The snow had turned back to rain during the day, making travel on the roads into a muddy mess. Later in the day, everything began to refreeze, making the wet soldiers even more miserable. Despite the continuing problems with ice in the river, the army spent much of the evening and night moving everything back to Pennsylvania. Many officers and men had been up for 3 straight days and nights, running on little more than adrenaline. As I said, many suffered from frostbite, hypothermia, and other illnesses brought on as the result of being cold, wet, hungry, and sleep-deprived. The river was even icier than the night before, and the army, as I said, had to move the 900 prisoners, as well as 6 additional cannon and numerous captured horses and other equipment, in addition to everything they had brought over the first time. Many soldiers reported trying to walk across the ice to reach the boats, only to have it break and have them fall into the river. There were no reports of drowning, but, of course, getting soaking wet in freezing water could have very real consequences for your health. Even so, the men were buoyed by their win, and this was the most hardcore of the larger army that had been dwindling down over the prior few months. As one example, during the battle, a gun carriage I mentioned had broken, meaning that the cannon no longer had wheels and could not be moved. General Knox had ordered the gun spiked and abandoned as part of their retreat. One sergeant refused to do so. He got 4 other soldiers to help him drag the cannon as dead weight across the ground for miles back to the river. This cannon was probably like 2,000 pounds. Dragging the weapon was slow going, so slow that even the rear guard passed them. General Knox once again rode up and told them to abandon the gun and get to the river. At one point, the team thought a party of British light horse was approaching them, although it turned out fortunately for them to be a group of Quakers. They eventually got the gun to the river and into a boat. General Knox rode up and asked them where this gun had come from. When the men told him it was the one he had ordered abandoned at Trenton, he praised the men for their initiative in bringing it back anyway, at great risk to themselves. So these are the kind of self-motivated, enthusiastic, hardworking men we're talking about. With great effort, by the morning of December 27th, the day after the battle, the bulk of the army, equipment, and prisoners were all safely back in Pennsylvania. On the 27th, General Washington had lunch with some of the captured Hessian officers. They discussed the battle and what the Hessians had done wrong. By all accounts, it was a polite, cordial, and friendly meeting between professional officers. General Washington even granted Hessian Lieutenant Witterholt parole to return to Trenton and collect some personal property that he had left behind. Witterholt returned to Trenton, collected his items, and then returned to the American lines to begin his imprisonment. Such was the level of trust and honor between officers. Washington, however, was not quite ready to declare victory and settle into winter quarters. On the afternoon of the 27th, he held another council of war to discuss the possibility of future operations to follow up on their success. As the council met, a courier arrived with news. Remember Colonel Cadwallader, who was supposed to cross the Delaware the same night as Washington, but further downriver? Well, he had failed to cross that night or the next day. But on the morning of the 27th, his men, mostly Pennsylvania Associators, which are local militia, had managed to get 1,800 men across the river and were near Burlington, New Jersey. They had gotten word that Washington had reached Trenton and were all the more motivated to participate in the attack and join him. By the time they learned that afternoon that Washington forces had retreated back to Pennsylvania, they decided, after some debate, to proceed forward anyway. So while Washington was retreating, another army was advancing, with communication delays leading to all this confusion. Now, the Associators, who are now in New Jersey, found the Hessians, mostly those under Colonel Von Dunnop, in disarray. It turned out that Von Dunnop was so shaken when he got news of Trenton that he immediately retreated north toward Princeton. He even abandoned some of his own sick and wounded to speed up the retreat, but, according to at least one source, did not abandon the 150 wagons full of plunder that his army had taken. That evening, scouts rode as far as Allentown, New Jersey, a small town east of Trenton, where Colonel Von Dunnop's Hessians had spent the previous night. They learned Von Dunnop had divided his retreating force, moving to both Princeton and Brunswick. With the Hessians in full retreat and with the Associators now across the river, Washington believed they could force all enemy forces out of the area and retake West Jersey. Some of Washington's generals in Pennsylvania thought this was madness. The Continental Army was still sick and exhausted from its first raid. They were not ready to launch another raid. Some of the men had not even made it back to their camps until noon that day. Even healthy men needed time to sleep, eat, and dry out. Also, the British could very likely be sending reinforcements from New York to crush whatever resistance they found. That was why they had crossed back into Pennsylvania in the first place. If the British won a victory in the days following their loss of Trenton, the British would then change the narrative back to an inevitable British victory in the war. After considerable discussion, the consensus developed that the army had to attempt a second crossing and fight the enemy again. It appeared that the enemy, at least for the moment, was disorganized and inclined to retreat. If the Continentals could follow one victory with another, they could prove that the raid on Trenton was not a little fluke on a small outpost. Further, the Trenton victory would encourage thousands of militia to get involved with the renewed winter campaign. Washington sent out orders the next morning, December 28th, that the army would once again cross the Delaware on December 29th and engage the enemy. He also sent riders through New Jersey and Connecticut, calling on militia to turn out and support the new Continental offensive. The Continental Army would return to Trenton and continue its winter campaign. The first step in any offensive would be to cross the Delaware River again. This time, the army would be bringing even more men and equipment than the first time. Fortunately, they were not tied to the strict deadline of getting everyone over in one night. Although part of this second crossing did take place at night, it continued well into the following day. The weather had gotten even colder in the days since the first crossing, making the river ice and creating even greater difficulty. The Americans also had to contend with about 6 inches of snow, which fell during the crossing. The ice on the river, as I said, had gotten worse, but with time, the army found its way across, often breaking through the ice by hand as it made its way across the river. The army was also able to use more ferries and already had a large contingent of the Pennsylvania Associators in New Jersey under the command of Colonel John Cadwallader and Continental General Thomas Mifflin. Uncharacteristically, the Continentals at this time did have sufficient arms and ammunition for a new campaign. They also had received shipments of tents and blankets to replace those lost during the retreat from Fort Lee. But a new difficulty arose during the crossing, the Continental Army ran out of food. Part of the problem was that soldiers were not allowed to forage and simply take food from the local citizens at gunpoint. And the local farmers were unwilling to sell food for Continental dollars, which were simply pieces of paper, which were worth less and less every day. The blame, though, for the lack of food fell mostly on a man named Carpenter Wharton, a Philadelphia businessman who had served as deputy commissary general. He has been accused of incompetence and corruption, and it does seem that this member of the powerful Philadelphia family of Whartons did seem more concerned that he and his friend profited from the war contracts than in actually supporting the war generally. A few months after these events, Wharton would be charged with treason and forced to resign his post. But I wouldn't read too much into the treason charge. As I said, he came from a Quaker family that got into trouble for refusing to sign parole agreements and were generally expelled from Philadelphia. So these treason charges may have been really a less than enthusiastic endorsement of the Continental cause. But in any event, finding food for the army without any money to pay for it was a pretty difficult and thankless task at the time. That said, I would not exactly put Mr. Wharton among the most dedicated of patriots. For the moment, Washington had to halt the crossing temporarily on December 30th to keep part of his force in Pennsylvania. He absolutely needed the food before they could be deployed to the field. After Washington shot off a letter to Robert Morris in Philadelphia, Morris was able to get Wharton to begin moving food supplies to the army in the field, at least enough to keep them from starving for a few days. With the food crisis resolved, Washington now faced a second crisis. Many soldiers felt unappreciated. The food shortage was only one recent example of how the civilian population simply refused to supply the army with any adequate supplies of food, clothing, and shelter. Despite the recent victory at Trenton, many of the men in the Continental Army who had not yet deserted remained there because they felt honor-bound to serve out their enlistments, which ended on December 31st, just a day or two away. When that time came, they planned to go home. Among these men were Glover's New England Mariners, who had been critical to the multiple river crossings for the army. Most of the men wanted to go join privateer ships, where they could continue to support the war effort, but also collect money prizes for captured property. Other soldiers simply had had enough misery. They had done their part. It was time for someone else to step up and replace them. Recruiters were having better luck now enlisting new soldiers based on the victory at Trenton. Others would take up the burden of service. But these new recruits would not arrive for at least several weeks, and they would be raw, inexperienced soldiers. Despite embarking on this new campaign into New Jersey, the officers could not convince most of the men to remain in the field. And for that matter, many of the junior officers were ready to go home as well. Many of the militia had been convinced to participate in the campaign with a promise of $10 hard money. This was not Continental paper, we're talking real gold and silver. Privates were normally paid just over $6 a month, usually in paper, and that's if they received it at all. So $10 was not a huge sum, although Washington found it extravagant. He needed to keep his army in the field for a few more weeks, or there would be no way to run a winter campaign. So Washington assembled his soldiers whose enlistments were about to expire, and personally made them an offer of a $10 bounty for anyone who remained for just a few more weeks. Not a single man stepped forward to take him up on the offer. Undeterred, Washington tried to appeal to their sense of duty. He told them, "My brave fellows, you have done all I asked you to do, and more than can be reasonably expected. But your country is at stake, your wives, your houses, and all that you hold dear. You have worn yourselves out with fatigues and hardships, but we know not how to spare you. If you will consent to stay 1 month longer, you will render that service to the cause of liberty and to your country which you probably can never do under any other circumstances. With those words, almost every man stepped forward to volunteer to continue the fight. No amount of money could convince them to fight. But the fact that their commander absolutely needed them to continue the cause did convince them. Moved by their agreement, Washington did not require any of them to sign their extended enlistments. Instead, they would be held accountable by their honor to the service. Washington then faced another problem. He did not have any hard money to pay the bounties that he had just promised these brave men. Once again, Washington turned to Robert Morris, explained the situation, and pleaded with him to come up with money by any means necessary. Morris, himself a wealthy merchant, had already turned over all of his hard currency to the cause. He had to turn to a wealthy Quaker friend. According to legend, the friend asked what security he had that Morris would repay the loan. Morris replied that he only had his word and his honor. In other words, he had to promise to repay the loan from his personal funds, not that of the government. With that, the Quaker went to his backyard and dug up his hidden chest of coins. That would be used to keep the Continental Army in the field. With the food, money, and reenlistment issues resolved, at least for the moment, the Continental Army, with its militia auxiliaries, was once again ready for battle in New Jersey. They knew they would continue to confront the British Army, but were not exactly sure what the British would do next. Next week, the New Jersey campaign continues with the Second Battle of Trenton. Hi, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. I had a great time at History Camp Virginia last weekend. I got to present on the politics of independence, as well as hang out with Christian D'Espagna, the author of a Joseph Warren biography, First Martyr, and Gabe Neville of the 8th Virginia blog. I also got to meet some other history podcasters like Susan O'Cherry Stevenson of American Epistles. I also appreciate the many kind words that fans of the show gave me during the weekend. It's really nice to meet you in person. And it really heartens me to hear from people who are enjoying this project. As I mentioned last week, I'm also working with the folks at History Camp to bring the first History Camp to Philadelphia on May 2nd, 2020. Also, the next History Camp Boston will take place on March 14th. So if anyone's interested in presenting or just attending either of these History Camps, please visit historycamp.org for more details. This week we heard about Washington's decisions in the aftermath of the Trenton victory. I often wonder if Washington even expected to be alive at this point. Although he never really expressed any defeatism, he knew that the Trenton attack was a very high-risk action, and he took a prominent role in its execution, exposing himself to enemy fire. He must have at least known that he stood a good chance of being killed, especially if the attack failed, and I expect he would have preferred death to having to surrender his army in defeat. So, having proven successful, Washington really did not seem to have much of a plan about what to do next. His decision to retreat back to Pennsylvania and then move back to New Jersey again a couple of days later seems to indicate that. His communications between himself and Colonel Cadwallader's army a few miles to the south also seems almost slapstick, as one did not seem to know what the other was doing. Cadwallader's men crossed into New Jersey thinking that Washington was at Trenton, while Washington was crossing back into Pennsylvania thinking Cadwallader was there. A couple of walkie-talkies would have made the whole thing so much simpler. That said, it certainly worked out for the best. If Cadwallader had not crossed into New Jersey as Washington was returning, Washington might have been less inclined to reverse his decision about leaving New Jersey in the first place. He might have stayed in Pennsylvania and let Cornwallis reoccupy New Jersey. What became an entire campaign could have been just a mere two-day raid. Of course, that campaign, as I've said, really changed the course of the war. I've already recommended a couple of books about this crucial campaign, and today I want to recommend another one, The Winter Soldiers by Richard Ketchum. This book is a classic, first published in 1973. It covers the events leading up to the 10 crucial days between Washington's crossing and the Battle of Princeton, and then goes into great detail about those events. At over 400 pages, not counting notes and index, it gets into plenty of detail. Now, some have criticized Ketchum's writing as being a bit dry and flat, but I find it rather straightforward. A big focus is the struggle of the average soldier, not only against the enemy, but more often against the elements. The perspective of the everyday soldier in the field is an interesting one for me. Ketchum was a prolific writer with at least half a dozen books on the American Revolution alone. He sadly passed away in 2012. Winter Soldiers is one of his earlier books, and I think well worth reading. For my online recommendation this week, I want to recommend Gabe Neville's 8th Virginia blog. Gabe explores the Revolution through the eyes of the 8th Virginia Regiment, which was raised in the counties of Western Virginia. They fought some key battles of the war, and many of the members settled Western lands that helped the young country to grow after the war. Gabe's well-researched and very detailed blog articles help provide a look at the Revolution from a different perspective. So if you want to take a look, go to 8thvirginia.com. That's the number 8thvirginia.com. I'll also put a link on my website at amrevpodcast.com. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.